morning. I'll call this session to order so that we can have the most possible time to listen to the papers and respondent and perhaps leave some time for you. I think that it's not any longer necessary to say that it's important for people to register, but in case you haven't, you may register in the hall on the extreme east end when this is over, if you have not already. It is my pleasure today to introduce Philip Barlow, who will present the paper as outlined in your program. Brother Barlow has a bachelor's degree from Weber State College, a master of theological studies from Harvard University, where he is now a doctoral candidate in American religious history. He has been for 3 years an instructor at the Institute of Religion in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and is right now involved in two works in progress, a book on the Atonement and a dissertation on the revivalist Charles Finney. I'll present to you at this time Brother Barlow, who will be followed by Gerald Bradford as responding to his paper. Brother Bradford teaches in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara, where he is also director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And I will not interrupt the proceedings after Brother Barlow, and we'll just go right on into the response.
My paper turns out to be a trifle long for this forum, and so you'll forgive me or perhaps applaud me for abridging here and there and climbing out of character. I brought a prop. Thank you. That only needs a paragraph.
Moments.
Right. The morals of our people, wrote Boston's John Adams, favorably comparing his own home ground to every place else in general, are much better. Their manners are more polite, and their manners are more agreeable. Our language is better, our taste is better, our persons are handsomer, our spirit is greater, our laws are wiser, our religion is superior. The charming geographical chauvinism celebrated in such a proclamation has comparable expressions in other cities. The New Yorker magazine, as I hope you're catching a glimpse of, non-verbally depicted the Big Apple's version some years ago on its cover. Its art has been widely plagiarized since. The picture caricatures, as you saw, the pronounced self-interest of New York citizens by showing Ninth Avenue and environs in great detail, and reveals disdain for the outside world by depicting everything across the Hudson with rapidly diminishing attention. Thus, there is an all-important here and us, and an all-but-irrelevant there and them. Recognizing that I could not with words hope to do the painting justice, I brought it with me, and those of you who care to peek at it in a little bit more detail afterwards will appreciate that Utah enjoys the relative status of being placed on the map at all, but suffers the singular indignity of being located somewhere south of Las Vegas and north of Texas. Apparently, in the minds of some New York citizens, Utah is out there to the extent that it may be south of Las Vegas. I am told by the well-traveled that Salt Lake City, which lies, after all, in the shadow of the church office building, joins rank with Boston and New York and perhaps only a dozen other cities in the world, each of which half believes it is the hub of the solar system. Pity Copernicus. Religious chauvinism in particular, however, has its own distinctive twists. Henry Fielding, in The History of Tom Jones, articulated through the mouth of one of his characters a particularly common form. He has his parson Thwackum cant that, quote, "When I mention religion, I mean the Christian religion. And not only the Christian religion, but the Protestant religion. and not only the Protestant religion, but the Church of England. And when I mention honor, I mean that mode of divine grace which is not only consistent with, but dependent upon this religion, and is consistent with and dependent upon no other. Now, religious chauvinism has diverse manifestations. Some are comic, some benign, and some vicious. Among the latter are intolerance and persecution. But these, though highly dangerous, are also obvious, sufficiently so that the sort of audience I anticipate attending such a conference as this will not likely be edified by their elaboration. What may be more helpful is to suggest that we, all people, need to understand more deeply than we seem to, at times, that we may be genuinely enriched, morally and spiritually and theologically, by an appreciation of the religious perspectives of those of other faiths. In saying this, I do not mean simply to invite religious toleration. I intend rather that we have something real to learn from other people's religion. By looking more deeply than we often do, we may indulge in an exercise of authentic religious betterment. It need not be a threat to one's religious faith to listen and learn across denominational lines. May I give to my Mormon friends an example? Across the street from my office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, kneels a statue. The statue is placed discreetly behind the chapel. By all appearances, he has knelt there a great while. His head is raised, his back is arched, his palms are lifted to his face, perhaps stopping tears. His posture is one of profound despair. The statue is occasionally my companion. I have spent some hours alone with him, responding to or identifying with him. He remains unnamed to the best of my knowledge, so I call him Anguish. To me, he means the abyss of not knowing, or the agony of personal or global sin. He means fear. He means participation in human estrangement and unjustified suffering, comprehension of the human condition. My observant wife points out that, did his hands not obscure his eyes, he might be staring at the cross on the steeple's top. Perhaps then he also means compassion for the suffering Christ, compassion not signifying not merely sympathy for, but suffering with. I have considered the likelihood of such a troubled statue finding station on Temple Square or on some other distinctly Mormon ground. It seems to me improbable. I do not mean a "look how much the pioneers suffered for us" statue. We have that kind already, and they are appropriate tributes to valiant people. But I mean art that reflects my stake in the universal plight of the race. It is hardly surprising that our public places house no such art, for Mormonism is, after all, and finally, an optimistic, proselyting faith. And it is well. Yet, Anguish is a part of my reality, and Mormons are left largely without a public mechanism to convey and share that reality. They might profit from the reflections of their non-Mormon friends whose cultural strictures are not their own. Analogous observations might be proffered at many points, but my purpose here is not lamentation, nor is it even criticism, at least as many ecclesiastical leaders seem to apprehend that term. Running the affairs of the church is a monumental task, and I revere and appreciate those who do it. My motive in broaching the problem at all is rather in the direction of an invitation. There is much to be gained and little but narrowness to be lost in understanding and learning from the religious traditions of others. If the Mormon people may be invited to transcend an unnecessary dogmatism and parochialism, I must insist that the invitation holds for their Protestant and Catholic counterparts. There is much to be learned from the insights of Mormonism, and the world would be well served to listen. Many critics of Mormonism are either patently unfair or demonstrably uninformed. This sort hardly invites our response. Among the more thoughtful, however, the aspect of Mormon theology which seems most often to offend is its perspective that mankind may literally partake of the divine nature, may become gods. It does not require a clever person to understand why such a doctrine grates on many ears. in our post-neo-Orthodox, post-Reformation world, a theology which understands the divine and human natures to be so intimately joined must somehow allow for the insights of Luther and Calvin and Karl Barth, who single-mindedly stress the chasm between creator and creature. Thinkers as early and prestigious as Augustine held that pride, the desire to become like to God and overpass the limits set on human beings as creatures, was the initial sin of Adam and Eve. The thought of man's participation in the divine nature seems to many sensitive souls to be the embodiment of blasphemy. The examination of these conflicting theological thrusts will receive no profound treatment here. The inabilities of the author are compounded by present space limitations. Nevertheless, because this Latter-day Saint tenet has proved so troublesome, I should like to attempt to portray it in historical perspective. It may be that non-Latter-day Saints also have something to learn from the beliefs of others. I shall use my remaining words to explore the idea of divinization, which with the word deification I shall use as roughly equivalent to the Greek word theosis, being made divine, as it has existed in Christian history. My immediate point within the broader thesis of religion cross-denominational learning is that the notion of the potential deification of man has existed among prominent Orthodox, a difficult word, Orthodox, but it has existed among well-accepted and well-known Christian writers in every century since Christendom's founder walked the earth. Entertaining the possibility of human exaltation has not always been viewed as antithetical to humility. At many times, in fact, and in many writers, it has served as the basis for the humble pursuit of the Christian life. Certain peculiarities of Western Christian history, among them the Roman Catholic Eastern Orthodox schism, the Protestant Reformation, and the two great American religious awakenings, have served to obscure that fact. Deification theology has assumed many different forms and meant many different things to many different groups in many different contexts. But important writers in every Christian era, especially in earliest Christianity, have insisted, if I can italicize my voice, that human deification is the essence of the meaning of Christ. Such thoughts, as we shall see, emerge from surprising quarters. It is cause for dialogue between Mormons and their friends. The idea of human exaltation is admittedly a dangerous concept. Its misuse might easily lead to blasphemous or even bizarre expressions. The late Jim Jones, who may serve almost as an archetype of bizarre and blasphemous things, is a case in point. Among the 971 audio tapes from California and Guyana which Jones left to posterity may be found thoughts to this end. Quote, Christianity was never based on the idea of an unknown God. Jesus said that every human being was a God. It's written that you're a God, and I'm a God, and you're a God, but until I see that all of you know who you are, I'm going to be very much what I am. Deification concepts may thus assume a clearly pathologic character. It is perhaps all the more striking, then, to find the notion in the 20th century's champion defender of Orthodox Christianity, C.S. Lewis. Lewis is claimed as ally not only by Mormons, but by Christians of many varieties, particularly by evangelicals, those who are perhaps most wounded by Mormonism's alleged conceited claims. There are no ordinary people, writes Lewis. Rather, we live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. The dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship. This is everywhere in Lewis, and there are a number of other quotes that I won't go into for want of time. In the Screwtape Letters, he has his devil admit that the enemy, that is God, really does want to fill the universe with a lot of loathsome little replicas of himself whose life, character, is meant to be like his own qualitatively on a smaller scale. The concept of deification may hardly be said to be incidental to Lewis's writing. It is, to borrow an obnoxious phrase from an old chemistry professor, utterly ubiquitous. We could trace this through the 20th century in a number of writers. Will Durant, while not buying into the proposition, thought it was everywhere in modern man, that modern man had the impulse and the desire to raise himself to a godlike and immortal destiny. And Santayana and others, many people believe and many people critique the position, but the notion is prevalent. The previous century, Joseph Smith's own, was even more full of the idea than the present one. Some of his current critics, ignoring or ignorant of the concept's longevity, have thought this fact fully explained the prophet's use of it. As in our own 19th century formulated divinization theology with radically varying intentions, it was used atheistically, as in Feuerbach, quote, God is merely the image of what man could be. It was used in self-centered ecstasy by the romantic writers, as in Whitman, quote, divine I am inside and out, and I make holy whatever I touch. It was even used as a cousin to manifest destiny by President-elect Andrew Jackson. I believe, he says, that man can be elevated. Man can become more and more endowed with divinity, and as he does, he becomes more godlike in his character. In William Ellery Channing, Theodore Parker, Margaret Fuller, the brilliant and eccentric anticipator of the women's rights movement, many of those associated with the transcendental and the nascent transcendental movement and emerging out of Unitarianism, these things can be found all over this kind of, as in Margaret Fuller's case, in short, we become gods and are able to give the life which we now feel ourselves able only to receive. And I note that it's kind of interesting that Fuller's comments come several years before Joseph Smith's King Follett discourse, although it is apparent from the Revelations, as in the 76th section, that at least as early as 1832, Joseph was receiving revelations that implied or in some cases were more explicit in suggesting that man could become God or godlike. In the interest of brevity, I can do no more than sample a divinization idea through the preceding 1800 years. That seems an immodest task. My point, in any case, will be best illustrated by a slightly more detailed glimpse at the earliest Christian centuries. In 1647, the Regius professor of Hebrew at Cambridge University, Ralph Cudworth, preached a sermon before the House of Commons. His thought is representative of the perfectionist impulse which, it is commonly held, culminated in the preaching of John Wesley in the next century. Cudworth defined to the commons what he took to be the object or end of the Christian witness. Quote, the end of the gospel is life and perfection. 'Tis a divine nature to make us partakers of the image of God. Happiness is nothing but goodness itself, and this is the same thing we call holiness, and I mean by holiness nothing else but God stamped and printed upon the soul. I'm going to skip a large chunk of human history here and try to encapsulize it for you. Other conceptions existed than that which I'm about to articulate, but one of the most common conceptions of man being made God that existed most prominently through the Middle Ages was the idea of a mystical union with God. I have cited here everybody from Pseudo-Dionysus, the Areopagite, to Catherine of Genoa, to Meister Eckhart, the seed of God is within us, and capacity, the seed that's in us is actually in need. Since we have the seed in us, the capacity to become God is actually in need. Other thoughts all over, but they sort of mean a mystical union almost in a Hinduistic sense, as a drop of water upon death may, if it succeeds in extracting itself from the circle of mortal existences, can merge with the great ocean, and they almost mean something like that, or at least the language grows similar. However, it is of particular note to me to observe that deification talk may be located not only in figures of peripheral importance to Christian history, but also in persons without whom that history would look substantially different. Thomas Aquinas, almost certainly the most important theologian to Roman Catholicism even to date, may serve as an instance. In the note which follows, Aquinas is examining the promotion of man toward the good. In fine scholastic style, he is making his fifth point on the second article of the first question of the third section of his Summa. He argues that the incarnation was appropriate, quote, in respect of the full participation in divinity, which is man's true blessedness and the end of human life, and this is conferred on us by the humanity of Christ. And to clarify his point, he then quotes an earlier writer, as he was wont to do, quote, God became man that man might become God. Now with this, we have reached a crucial point in our discussion, for in the words God became man that man might become God, we have discovered a verbal formulation which has been handed down through the ages from Christian leaders of one century to another. The formula was once locked into the Christian consciousness in a manner analogous to the way in which Lorenzo Snow's famous couplet, as man now is, God once was, is lodged in the Mormon mind. Thinkers of different eras understood the thought variously as the pressure of their theological context dictated. But the formula itself changed very little from the earliest Christian fathers. Hence, Maximus the Confessor, by consensus the greatest thinker of the 7th century, speaks much like Aquinas on this point, though the two were separated by half a millennium. He became what we are, insists Maximus, in order that we might be what he is. In point of fact, Aquinas, in explaining why Christ became incarnate, was quoting his favorite authority, the man who for Christian history ranks as the most influential extra-biblical theologian of all time, St. Augustine. Now, the wonderful or wretched thing about Augustine is that he wrote, or rather dictated, such a mountain of books that, like the Bible, he may be and is used as authority for almost any imaginable theological stance. The old joke is, if anyone tells you he has read all of Augustine, hold that man to be a liar. The revered saint was, in fact, saved from the fate of Origen, that is, saved from having his works later anathematized and himself declared a bad person, general heretic. He was saved from that fate by followers, by disciples who later reworked his theology after his death, utilizing the minority of his writings which suited their purposes. Luther likewise was highly selective in his liberal borrowing from Augustine. It is inevitable. Despite Augustine's familiar stress on the notion of grace, however, he too inherited and used the formalized theology which we are considering. Quote, we were not to follow man who could be seen. We were to follow God who could not be seen. Wherefore, that man might be shown one whom he could both see and follow, God was made man. Elsewhere he writes, God became man, that man might become God. Apollinaris of Laodicea summarized the creedal form, in creedal form, the central tradition of the church, which, I'm trying to italicize my voice again, which actually defined deification itself in terms of deification. Did I say that right? They meant by atonement and salvation the process of being made divine. We declare that the Logos, that is the Word of God, became man for the purpose of our salvation, so that we might receive the likeness of the Heavenly One and be made God after the likeness of the Son. In the Church Fathers who are contemporary with or who antedate Apollinaris, that is those of the 2nd through the 4th centuries, particularly in the more sophisticated Eastern Church, it is almost difficult to find an important writer who does not allude to the conception of man's eventual deification. Gregory of Nazianzus taught that I may become God to the same extent as he became man. Basil of Caesarea preached that the Holy Spirit aids man in being made like to God and, highest of all, being made God. Athanasius, the champion defender of the Nicene version of the Trinity, also championed the deification understanding of salvation. Quote, God the Logos assumed humanity that we might become God. Deification theology takes on a different light as one delves earlier into the 3rd and then into the 2nd centuries. This is so because the Christological and theological context becomes first less clearly Trinitarian and then not clearly Trinitarian at all. Hence, what the writers of this period may have meant when they spoke of becoming gods looks somewhat different than in later years when the Trinitarian conceptions were taken for granted. Origen urged all to flee with all power from being men and make haste to become gods. From Christ, he wrote, there began the union of the divine with the human nature, in order that the human, by communion with the divine, might rise to be divine, not in Jesus alone, but in all those who not only believe, but enter upon the life which Jesus taught. Origen's teacher, Clement of Alexandria, that's under some dispute now, but if he was Origen's teacher, at least his predecessor, Clement was, made certain that no one ought to mistake deification for simple immortality, as at least one influential modern writer has done. Says Clement, the soul, which is kept pure, receiving the Lord's power, studies to become a god. Additionally, he constructs an especially clear rendition of the by now familiar formula. The Logos of God had become man, so that you might learn from a man how a man may become God. Irenaeus is among the most influential and representative of the early Orthodox defenders against heresy. His writings are replete with allusions to the uniting of man to God and man's partaking of God's splendor. And how shall man pass into God, he rhetorically queries, if God had not been caused to pass into man? Irenaeus noted a divinely ordained progression from manhood to godhood in order to perfect us to be what he is, Jesus Christ our Lord, came to the earth. Now, as far as I can determine, we have in Irenaeus and Clement the earliest lucid and indisputable formulations of the divinization or theosis view of salvation which have been preserved to us. The fact that the concept appears almost contemporaneously in these two writers who were so geographically distant, however, assures the existence of an earlier tradition from which they drew. This takes us very nearly to the period when the last of the New Testament documents were being composed. At this early date, not only those whom the modern Christian world thinks of as Orthodox, but even their principal rivals, the Christian Gnostics, shared the belief that an essential element in Christ's mission was to reveal and exemplify the path out of sin and toward the deification of human nature. If one would accurately interpret the numerous biblical allusions to this concept, one must attempt to transcend the Reformation-manufactured lens through which much of the modern Christian world views theology. One must allow for the understanding of the early church. As a consequence of the necessarily abbreviated length of this essay, I have avoided details about what each of the figures actually thought they were saying when they wrote of being made God. But we should at least note here, even in passing, that if a person like the 12th century man Michael Psellus, if he believes in a God without body parts and passions, then one might define deification as he did, as the successful fleeing of your body parts and passions and the ability to deify others. So clearly there's a sense in which the various deification allusions we have considered have only verbal similarities to Mormon understandings of exaltation. I therefore do not wish to be misunderstood as implying that any or all of the thinkers referred to herein thought of theosis just as the Mormons do. On the other hand, the affinities with Mormon thought of some thinkers are striking. Particularly in earliest Christianity, some writers believe that Christ was the express image of his Father, the revelation to man of what God is, and the revelation of what man may become. Early Christians were invited to study to become gods, and it was clearly held that they would eternally retain their resurrected individuality, becoming all that God is without becoming ontologically indistinguishable from him. This they would do as a result of the grace of God and as a result of their own actions in response to that grace. Most of the writers I have cited use deification language to emphasize the noble possibilities, though not always ignoring the sinfulness of human beings. This link with Mormon thought is not superficial, but fundamental. What most deeply offends many critics of Mormonism is precisely the fear that too lofty a conception of human nature will lead to the root of all sin, human pride. Yet major Christians of every Christian era have thought otherwise. It may hardly be disputed that theologies of deification have had a long and rich life throughout the Christian past. Their absence in the historiography does not remove, but only obscures, their existence in history proper. These theologies exist sometimes as contrast to, but often in creative tension with, theologies which stress the depravity or the creatureliness of man. They exist in the writings of many of the most important theologians of all Christendom. They are most prominent in the literature bequeathed us by the early church fathers quite before the creedal formulations of a Trinity or of a creation ex nihilo. The 3rd and 4th century church inherited deification ideas from the earliest fathers. The language of deification remained relatively stable, while its meaning evolved in connection with the working out of Trinitarian formulations. Substantially, I think, under the influence of Augustine, who early used deification talk but later discarded it, the Western Church, what would evolve into Roman Catholicism, eventually abandoned these conceptions and they fell into disuse. And it is very interesting to trace the sermons of some of these persons who in the earlier years and more in the eastern part of the church are always using scriptures from Psalms 82, I think it is, where it says, "Ye also are gods," and that kind of talk. That kind of stuff is there early and more constantly in the east and fades reasonably rapidly in the west. Americans and Western Europeans have inherited their traditions from the Western Church through Roman Catholicism and or the Reformation. Consequently, they have not been attuned to those beliefs of earliest Christianity which were maintained by Eastern Orthodoxy as inherited from the primitive Eastern Church. And it was in the Eastern Church that deification was for centuries the central, not just a or an important, but deification was the central theological idea. If there is any substance at all to the concept of mankind's potential exaltation, one might legitimately ask why God would ever reveal such a thing. If the essential human task is to walk in faith, to humbly pursue righteousness, and to emulate the Christ, why risk exacerbating the human propensity toward pride by revealing the almost unthinkable potential of the race? I shall indulge in a personal speculation. That's what institute teachers do, after all. It may be, as with years of counseling and introspection, as I have come to believe, that pride is not the fundamental human fault, the archetypical sin that it is often made out to be. Indisputably, there is a malady that may be described as irreducible pride. But I think that the basic human problem, and one on which much or most pride is based, that may be overstated, but I do think that at least much pride is possibly based on a profound and almost universal quest for a sense of self-identity and worth. The problem may be termed existential insecurity. It perhaps lies beneath some forms of that difficult-to-define pathology which psychologists call neurosis. When I discover myself indulging in prideful actions, name-dropping, perhaps, or the unnecessary use of an esoteric term, or the excessive pursuit of possessions or position, I frequently find, upon examination, that behind the veneer of pride and selfishness is an insecurity with what I am, an impulse to disguise myself to myself or to others. Mormonism holds to the belief that the bewailed situation of the human race is, despite all of its ignorance and suffering, a necessary and positive circumstance. A most fundamental corollary to this circumstance is existential insecurity. If you're going to have a planet Earth and you're going to insist on human freedom, then this insecurity will necessarily follow. The ultimate antidote for this insecurity is the condescension of God, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. The mission of God's antidote, Christ, to the suffering, sinful, neurotic human condition may be viewed fruitfully from several vantages. One of them is to explore the human potential for sin and the meaning of the cross. But another, equally necessary, is to explore the human potential for good, to understand that the Logos was made man in order that man might be made God. Not only the death, but the entire life of Christ was charis, the New Testament Greek word for grace, a free gift, an act of grace to which God's children are invited to respond. If it is so that, on the one hand, we must operate as mortals apart from the presence of God in freedom and faith, and on the other hand, that we share a desperate urge for direction and worth and identity, then there could have been perhaps no more appropriate response from the heavens than to send God's own Son as the revelation of what God is, which yields direction, and what we may become, which yields a sense of worth and identity. Hence the scriptural injunction to be perfect as, in the sense that God is perfect. Hence the promise that we are joint heirs with Christ of God. Hence the emphasis on our being made in the image of God, not only metaphorically, but at least for the writer of the fifth chapter of Genesis, in the same sense that Adam begat Seth in his own likeness after his own image. Hence the assurance that when God shall appear, we shall be like him. The spirit of the LDS hope in man's potential godhood is not, step right up, folks, you too can create a world. An idea ought not to be appraised by what fanatics do in its name. Deification theology, like any theology, may be abused or trivialized. I once read of a rabbi who, writing shortly after the Jewish Holocaust, insisted that no statement, theological or otherwise, ought to be made that would not sound credible in the presence of burning or starving children. I have used that test on my own conceptions, for as Lowell Bunyan has recently wrote, abstract theology has its place, but it saves men not in this world nor in eternity. A theological truth to be of genuine worth must have bearing on the pressing realities of this world. To the extent that the prospect of exaltation does no more than to provide a forum for intellectual gymnastics or to reinforce the hollow satisfaction that one is sitting in the right pew on the right religious team, then to that extent a powerful idea has lost its savor. The essence of the idea of deification in Mormon thought is that God has, by grace, revealed to man the proper way to realize himself, to respond to his difficult but necessary mortal surroundings. In order for man to realize himself, he must in some measure know himself. The riddle of man's essential nature has perplexed the best thinkers of our race. Pascal has fared better than many in this vein. He pondered at length the poles that mankind may touch. I take license here with his original intent, but his words portend more than he knew. Quote, "What sort of a freak, then, is man? How novel, how monstrous, how chaotic, how paradoxical, how prodigious. Judge of all things, feeble earthworm. Repository of truth, sink of doubt and error. Glory and refuse of the universe. Who will unravel such a tangle?" This is certainly beyond dogmatism and skepticism, beyond all human philosophy. Man transcends man. God's response to paradoxical man is revealed in the Christ. What is man? The Mormon position to the question is actually a mediating one between those who, like Unitarians, disparage the abyss and clutch of sin, and those who, like Luther, have looked so deeply at it that they have despaired of human dignity. Christ transcends both views. The potential evil of a human being is of such a depth that the Son of God died in the flesh to confront it. The potential good of a human being is of such a height that the Son of God lived in the flesh to reveal it. Truth is to be found in Thomas O'Day's assertion that every society may be viewed as an acted-out answer to the question, what ought man to be doing here on the earth, being the kind of being that he is? Mormons have a distinctive perception of the kind of being man is, and that perception has fundamental implications. those implications are too varied and too profound to be explored in depth here, but among them one ought to sense deeply one's own worth and dignity. One ought to comprehend that excessive self-loathing is a kind of blasphemy, an affront to the divine within. One ought clearly to discern the image of God in one's neighbor. Every person matters infinitely. One ought to recall that the most exact reflection of God's image, Jesus, was radically other-centered, was prepared to live among and lift the despised, was insistent that he wash his followers' feet. One ought to align oneself more anxiously with God's revealed purposes, for they are in reality one's own. Since granting immortality lies beyond our sphere, perhaps the nearest human approximation of God's work and glory is to labor to bring to pass the mortality, that is, the full humanity and eternal life of man. One ought therefore to see the irrelevance of many of our materialistic pursuits. One ought to see that in the theology of deification, one has a marvelous theological tool for screening pettiness from one's life. One ought to recognize and respond aggressively toward the diabolical in social systems that are, by way of sexual or racial or economic or even religious imperialism, limiting to human growth and therefore disconsonant with the revealed creative and constructive work of God. I began this paper by suggesting that religious chauvinism, like all chauvinism, runs decided risks. Mormons and non-Mormons experience those risks and participate in the results. I do not argue that the only or best alternative to chauvinism is the position that all religious perspectives are of equal value. It is not so. What I am suggesting is that all of us ought to be sufficiently unpretentious as to learn from those outside our particular group. One need not agree with all of my conclusions to sense that there is room for conversation here. It is necessary to our mutual well-being that we seek the virtuous, the lovely, and the things of good report, that we search for edification and truth from any source, including religious traditions other than our own. To fail to do so is to fail in humility, and arrogance never was godliness. Thank you.
Technically, we're out of time. This always happens this way. We ought to circulate a petition to Peggy and get her to organize these sessions a little better. I'll read my remarks as fast as I can to put them in the record, and I hope that we'll get at least something in the way of a discussion launched here. Philip Barlow was written, in my estimation, a very important paper, and this for two reasons. First, because of his decision to consider some of the crucial implications that can be drawn from the centrally important Mormon belief that humankind can become as God, written in an imaginative manner. And second, because of some incidental points which he brings up but does not develop, which likewise are of central importance in understanding Mormon thought, and go to the heart of what is needed to express this view of the world in a manner that others might best grasp. I want briefly to comment on these two points and try to draw them together. First, on the major thesis of Brother Barlow's paper. He has attempted to show that the Mormon belief that, quote, that mankind may literally partake of the divine nature, may become gods, unquote, can be seen to have been taught in various periods throughout Christian history, and that Mormons ought not to be accused of making up the idea, and that, more importantly, the controversial belief in fact supports and underwrites a positive estimate of human nature that can be shown to have all kinds of benefits, psychological, physical, and certainly spiritual, for those who understand themselves and see the world from this perspective. Barlow is stressing this particular implication of the Mormon teaching that all men may become gods is clearly the strongest point of his paper, in my view. Second, has Barlow proven his thesis, namely that the Mormon view of the relationship between humankind and the divine has been taught in other periods of Christian history? The answer must be, it all depends. From the Orthodox Christian perspective, the answer is probably no. This because virtually all of the teachings attributed to the authorities quoted by Barlow can and have been interpreted on these points in a way diametrically opposed to the meaning of the Mormon view that men may become gods. On the alternative rendering, most, if not all, of these sayings would be seen as expressing the truth, at least for Orthodox Christians, that man can become God in the sense that all of God's creation has within it the potential to be drawn back to and assimilated into the divine. The many shall in time become again the one. On this view, God became man, right, Christ, that man, right, humankind, might become God, or in the words of St. Paul, God was in Christ reconciling himself to the world. What Bala was shown is that the Western Christian tradition, let alone the Eastern Orthodox tradition, is rich in speculations about the nature of the divine, the meaning of the incarnation, and hence the possible relationship between God and man. But Bala himself admits that he does not wish to, quote, imply that any or all of the thinkers herein referring to the thought of deification do it in the manner that the Mormons do. Still, the issue, I think, goes much deeper than whether or not Barlow has proven his thesis. This brings me to my third and most important point. Barlow argues that this particular Mormon teaching is, quote, what seems often to offend most, because, of course, such a belief fosters and is reflective of the worst of human sins, human pride. I agree with Barlow that this teaching, even when it is expressed in the church in the best possible ways, often does cause offense, particularly among those on the right wing of evangelical Protestant Christianity in America, but for a reason that I think is more fundamental than the one suggested by Barlow, a reason that goes to the very heart of Mormon theology and its contrast with Orthodox Christianity, namely the distinctive Mormon view of God the Father, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit. Not that humankind may become as God, as it is sometimes put, but that men and women may become gods, and hence that Mormonism is to be classed among those traditions that view the divine as many and not one. Here is the chief cause of the theological difference between our tradition and others within the Christian tradition, and certainly between ourselves and the traditions of Judaism and Islam. Before I say more about this point, I want to comment on some of the incidental points which Barlow makes and try to show how they contribute to what is required of us properly to make ourselves understood on this key point of doctrine. First, Barlow's paper is predicated on a certain view and value of dialogue. I'll skip here simply to say that it's obvious that he values dialogue and thinks that it is workable, that new and insightful ideas come as a result of that. We need to keep in mind that within the church today, there are others who do not adhere to that view, who think that matters religious and theological come by distinctive ways, and that there's no profit in talking about these matters with others. Obviously, how Mormon views, particularly on such a sensitive doctrine as this, are expressed and understood will depend on how the church finally settles the issue of the value of dialogue. Also, in an earlier draft of the paper, I want to quote a part. He left it out, he told me before, just for brevity's sake, not that he didn't want to have this attributed to him. In the context of talking about the statue in that Episcopal Divinity School, which I've seen myself, incidentally, that he thinks it unlikely a statue like that will ever be found on Mormon property, he makes the following point. Analogous points may be offered. One thinks of such areas as the Mormon refusal to take 20th century biblical scholarship seriously, of the Mormon share in the inability of modern Western man to ritualize effectively, of the trivialization of 20th century Mormon symbols, of the embrace of the merchant ethic, of the suspect logic to justify rejection of the most powerful of all Christian images, the cross, and of the laudable emphasis on industry, pragmatism, and family at the expense of sacrificing contemplative public worship of God. Whether or not one agrees with Barlow's observations here, if they do prevail, I certainly do not think the situation needs to be that way. For example, we may not need to celebrate in various symbolic ways the negative, deprived image of human nature, but we can do much more than we do in our own tradition to symbolize the distinctive positive estimate of humankind that we believe in. Likewise, we may not need to embrace all of the conclusions that come from contemporary biblical scholarship to learn, even from our own experience in the tradition, and I think here particularly of the Adam God doctrine, of the dead-end road that is being traveled by those who take a dogmatic, literalistic approach to the study of scriptures. And lastly, we can fully appreciate the value and the relative simplicity of our own forms of public worship while continuing to search for appropriate, meaningful, and acceptable forms of ritual behavior that will strengthen the soul and enliven the spirit. In other words, I take it that Barlow, in this paper, is explicitly asking for, in these incidental comments, and implicitly illustrating in his paper, what must be recognized as an ongoing need in the church, at least for those of us so inclined, namely continually to strive in the most creative and imaginative ways possible to articulate the Mormon worldview, not only for the benefit of members of the tradition, but for others as well. In the case of the central point of Barlow's paper, this need centers on the requirement to be able to state fully and unequivocally to others what we believe to be the true nature of God, to face squarely the point that others will understand what we mean when we proclaim that humankind can become gods, only when we fully acknowledge that Mormon polytheism can never be squared with the prevailing form of monotheism that operates in other branches of Christianity, and that it is required of us to make our theological position on this point as clear as possible, and that while we can show evidence of such teachings in the Orthodox Christian traditions and even in the biblical text, finally we take our stand on such points not according to the norm of Orthodox Christianity, but on the authority of Latter-day Revelation. This is a Mormon way of saying something fundamental, something that always needs to be kept in mind in such discussions. It came up yesterday, particularly in the panel discussion with Tom Alexander and others. The groundwork of Mormon theology, just as any worldview, has its own integrity and authenticity. There is no Archimedean point from which all competing worldviews can be judged. The test of the efficacy of the Mormon view of the world has been made and will be made in the lives of countless individuals and will prove its worth only in these terms. Armed with this insight, the challenge before us is clear. It's incumbent upon us to work out the implications of this groundwork and test its relevance in our experiences of life itself. Lastly, in the face of these acknowledged differences, even in spite of them, we must continually assert our citizenship in the city of God, in the larger community of Christians, not only by way of doctrinal and emulation of Christ, but on the witness of personal and communal religious experience. What I take Brother Barlow's paper to be reflective of is this effort on our part better to understand our own position in light of the teachings of others, always sensing, and as I think Barlow does, the inherent limitations of such comparative efforts as he indulges in, but nevertheless trusting in our own ability to express the truth of our position in a straightforward and clear manner. To this end, I think Philip Barlow has made a real contribution. I think just a personal note, if I've learned anything in my studies of religion over the last few years, it is to learn to become sensitive to the sacred dimensions of life, wherever it is found. I found myself, for example, the other day in that same panel, a little put on edge by one of the panelists mistakenly referring to those who believe in Allah and follow the will of Islam as Mohammedans. That's an improper way to speak of others. We find today, unfortunately, in the church, and now, as you all know, increasingly outside of the church, people who have chosen to take this particular sensitive Mormon doctrine and treat it, at least on the part of some in the church, in a kind of offhanded way, in the part of those outside of the church, in a decidedly mocking way. That's a very serious, unfortunate turn of events for two reasons, I think. Number one, anyone who proceeds in this way to try to ridicule someone and thus build up their own position is flying in the face of a fundamental logical error. That no one can somehow make themselves better by tearing down someone else. And what in fact is happening, and I find most unfortunate,